There are some stories that just capture the zeitgeist of a moment. What we deem important, what we don't, and how we frame those issues to ourselves. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. This week, we're going in-depth with a couple of stories like that. One from Silicon Valley, and two from China. They get at some of the tensions and complexities in the global economy right now, and how people carve out their own place in it. Plus, we have all sorts of other good stuff. So come give us your feedback on our website, marketplace.org, on Marketplace's Facebook page, or on Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND. We are starting the show with our segment Long and Short, where we steal those terms from the world of finance and ask our panelists to bet on or against various things in the world of news and business. This week, we have Danielle Smith, culture lead for ESPN's new site, The Undefeated, and Marketplace reporter Andy Euler. Welcome to you both.
Hey, I'm so happy to be here.
Yeah, good to be here.
Andy, I will start with you because we have some news this week on something you've been covering a lot, which is the bankruptcy in Puerto Rico. So I know your long relates to that. Go ahead. Give it to me.
It does. I've been reporting on Puerto Rico for almost a year, and I am happy to be long on Puerto Rico. It looks like a Puerto Rico bill, an agreement has been reached between House Republicans and the White House that is going to allow Puerto Rico to restructure its debt, which has been a huge, huge issue. They don't have Chapter 9 bankruptcy protection. It's been a big deal. So I'm actually long on this because I think it's the first step in Puerto Rico getting some sort of relief or figuring out what it's going to do next, because I don't think this solves everything. It instills some financial oversight boards that I think a lot of Puerto Ricans, when I was on the island, they said, we don't want this to happen. We have, you know, kind of self-governing. I mean, Puerto Rico has its own constitution. It has this sort of interesting, as a territory, interesting element where it really does kind of get to do what it needs to do. And it says, look, the feds are coming in and they're instilling this oversight board, but they're also not taking responsibility for our debt. That's a really, really important kind of contentious element.
It's
is
weird.
That they're saying, yeah, in the end, we don't really want to have to deal with it. You're still going to be obligated to pay these bondholders. You're still going to be obligated for your debt. So it's this weird kind of compromise that a lot of Puerto Ricans don't like.
When you hear the phrase state of emergency, you know, with regard to the highway authority and things
right.
like that, are things falling apart? Is it as bad as it seems sometimes on Twitter?
Well, you're right. I mean, the thing is, they're closing schools. 150 public schools have been closed. We're talking about limiting hours in hospitals, and doctors are leaving the island because they don't have work. It's gotten so much worse so quickly. We always say debt crisis, and I think we kind of use that ubiquitously, but it really is getting to the point where it's like, this is a humanitarian crisis at this point.
All right, let's shift tacks a bit. Danielle, I want you to give me your long.
My long is we are going to be talking about the reboot of Roots. It debuts on Memorial Day weekend on the History Channel. It's supposed to be a very lush and amazing production, and I think everyone's going to be talking about it that week. I don't know if it's going to take over the entire country, kind of in the way the 1977 version of Roots did, but I think we're all going to be talking about it.
This is a question I have. With this Roots reboot, I guess if we want to call it that, coming back, we've also seen the real critical success and in a lot of ways rating success of Underground on the WGN.
It's like yes.
their highest rated scripted show. What does that tell us, do you think, about Americans' appetite for maybe wrestling with slavery?
It's really strange. I really think it probably has to do with, and one of our best writers, Soraya McDonald, is writing about it for The Undefeated, but I really think it has to do with the fact that slavery isn't really taught in schools as much as it could be and perhaps should be. And so people are curious and thirsty for information. It almost, do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And it's also something that we're, you know, I was kind of wrestling with this in my head. We're kind of afraid to talk about it. I'm a white dude and I'm afraid.
It's hard.
It's hard to talk about. And so, you know, having this happen on television almost takes us away, takes us out of it, where we can just kind of watch it and say, oh, wow, okay.
But it gives a good entry point, though, I think, for people to have the conversations, because
right.
I want to say for the record, white dude or not, black woman such as myself,
yeah.
Asian American person around the corner, Latin American senior, everyone, it's not an easy subject for any of us
exactly.
to talk about. So that's why I feel like there's going to be a lot of chatter in the tweets, as I like to call them, about this show.
You know, one point that you made that I think is really interesting is when the original Roots aired, 1977, we did not mm-hmm. have all these different cable channels, and were riveted.
Riveted.
Everyone was watching it. And so I'm curious whether it will have the same kind of power that it did in the 70s.
Well, I don't know if anything is going to be, to me, as amazing as it was in the 70s, but I do think there are moments, I mean, I guess they call them now trending topics, where something is the thing, you know, that everyone is talking about. And this has a chance to be one of those topics. And I think the History Channel is doing some interesting things. Even when something is taught, say like the American Revolution or the Cuban Missile Crisis or any of these big American moments, it's like, hey, is it taught in a compelling way? Are the kids really interested? How can teachers compete with what's going on the internet? And maybe amazing edutainment, as a rapper named KRS-One came up with that term a long time ago, yeah. Edutainment, right? He had an album called that, I think. I think we can start looking for a lot more of that. So now I've gone super long with the trend. I think,
on edutainment.
Right? Yes.
We're going on for a while, but Danielle, I'm going to let you throw out your short anyway. Give me your short.
Anything or anyone that is trying to say that Steph Curry and his whole entire family is not going to dominate the media and the world for the next 30 years. You heard it here first. He's running for president. That's my thing. He's doing it, man.
It's doing it.
Or Riley. I would vote for Riley Curry for president.
Right, Riley. I'm telling you right now, all this basketball thing is just an internship for him to run for president.
Steph Curry's internship with the NBA. I like that.
Yes.
Danielle Smith, Andy Euler, thank you both very much.
Thank you for having me. It's been so amazing.
No, thank you. It was so much fun.
Hi, it's Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening to Marketplace Weekend. We give you the context you need to understand what's happening in the economy and why it matters to you. Here's some context on us. Since we're a nonprofit, we rely on donations from our listeners to keep going. And we've just made special Let's Do the Numbers Pilsner glasses available to thank you for your support. Donate today at marketplace.org. This weekend, you can pack your children into the car and go see the Angry Birds movie. Yes, really. A movie based on the game you may have played on your phone. It reportedly cost $80 million to make, with a marketing budget of at least that size. Marketplace's entertainment correspondent Adrian Hill spoke with one of the movie's directors, Fergal Riley, and she joins me now to talk about turning an app into a movie. Okay, Adrian, why make this thing? And aren't we kind of over the obsession with Angry Birds?
Yeah, you know, it's fair. It does seem like we're a little bit past this. The movie, it turns out, was made in just 2.5 years, which sounds long, but in animated film, time is a very short period of time. And there's a lot of precedent for turning games or even toys without strong storylines into movies. I mean, we've got Legos, very successful franchise. We've got news that there's a live-action trilogy based on the game Tetris that apparently just got something like $80 million in funding. There's an emoji movie in the works. I asked Fergal Riley, who's one of the directors of Angry Birds, if he had any worries or questions or trepidations before he signed on to the project.
From my own experience working in animation, I knew that, you know, sometimes we start off with very simple premises. And the first question I guess I asked myself was, are we going to have the freedom to make the world really cinematic? You know, and it's not just going to be bouncing balls, basically, right, like in the game.
So, yes, it is far more than bouncing balls. He says they started with a really interesting question, which is, why are these birds so angry?
Oh.
Which, you know, it's interesting. And it's a lot more to start with than the Tetris folks have.
I guess that makes sense. And I could see from an animator standpoint, the idea that you're building this out of the animation, not the game. But still, Rovio, which is the company that made the app, is the one that financed this movie. Is this any more than a 90-minute-long ad for their game?
And the more I've been thinking about it, the more I feel like, isn't that what all animated movies really are? Just big, long ads for something. The opportunities for studios or brands to revive interest or to create whole new markets for these things is huge with animated films. I mean, look at the Frozen marketing world. It's amazing. So there is this potential, and I think that's what all these studios are looking for, is not just ticket sales, but how do we monetize this in all of these other ways. I asked Riley, though, how much freedom he had in creating the movie he wanted to make, considering this was being funded by the game studio.
At the beginning, Mikhail Head, who's one of the founders of Rovio, he's also one of the executive producers on the movie. He was a guiding influence, but he gave us really a long leash and sort of a big amount of freedom. And so we had full rein to sort of create the comedy out of that.
Let's pull back a little bit. Angry Birds, Tetris, emojis, Lego, and, you know, I guess what, the video games, World of Warcraft, Assassin's Creed, all of these things, thinking about them as the basis for movies. Why?
It's all about intellectual property these days. I mean, movies cost tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars to make, and studios want to make sure an audience shows up to watch them. So if you look at a lot of big budget movies coming out this summer, they're dominated by names, characters, or worlds that people are already familiar with. You've got more superhero movies, another Independence Day, a Tarzan movie, a sequel to Finding Nemo. I could just go on, but you don't have room in your show. The question is, which of these are going to hit? Which of these are going to connect to an audience and which aren't? I asked Riley how much the box office returns matter to him.
Animated movies are expensive to make, and I can go ahead and make more of them, you know, if the movie is profitable. But I never thought about that when we were making the movie. All we thought about is, are we having fun? Is our fun going to translate to the audience? And it's only now in the last week that you're thinking our audience is going to enjoy it as much as we did making it. And that translates hopefully into dollars.
You know, thinking about the dollars, that this is a movie aimed at children, which means that it's not me going in and buying a ticket. It's maybe a family of 3 or 4 or 5, and that's got to help the bottom line.
It does. I think the box office potential is part of what makes them so appealing to studios and to movie theaters, and why we've got a whole slate of them coming out this summer.
Marketplace's entertainment correspondent, Adrienne Hill, thank you very much.
Thanks, Lizzie.
There's a reason why we do the numbers on Marketplace so much, because behind every number, there's often a great story. On our website, marketplace.org, our By the Numbers blog finds the most interesting numbers in the news. Here are Marketplace's Raghu Manavalan and Tony Wagner with some of this week's news by the numbers. Tony?
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first number is
2.5 million.
That's how many people are expected to go through airport security screening every day this summer.
That would be a number of 231 million over the whole season, a new record.
It's a big problem for the TSA, which has been getting hammered for long waits and missed flights lately.
Industry watchers are worried people will skip flying altogether this year, which would cut into profits.
57.
That's the percentage of homes in San Francisco that are now worth $1 million or more. That's up from 20% 4 years ago.
Nationwide, the share of million-dollar homes has nearly doubled over that same period. That's according to the real estate site Trulia.
Housing prices and rents are pretty much up across the country, and there's no new starter homes being built, so good luck.
75,000.
Americans who earn that many dollars or more are twice as likely to participate in the sharing economy.
Like getting rides with an Uber or maybe renting an Airbnb for the weekend.
That's according to Pew Research, which also found that at least half of people making less than $30,000 hadn't even heard of those apps.
Man, I cannot wait until I'm rich enough to fly private and take an Uber to my Airbnb this weekend.
Oh, cool. I can't wait till I'm rich enough to buy a house.
She ain't got no money in the bank. No. She be walking around acting all stank. And now she at the party looking at me. Hope she can get saved by me. I'm looking at her. I ain't trying to save that girl. I ain't trying to save that girl. I ain't trying to save that girl. She got her hand up, but I ain't trying to pay that girl.
Now to a conversation about what we spend our money on. It's wedding season. And last week, we asked you, our listeners, about gifts you had given or received. We heard from a lot of you on Facebook and through voicemail. You asked for cash, for honeymoons and down payments, pots, place settings, glasses, crystal. And then we got some more unusual stories. Karen Swanson in Pittsburgh got married 14 years ago, and she wanted something really personal.
We were young and could have used a lot of cash and Target items, I'm sure, but my best friend from childhood's mother was a professional potter, and she offered to make us some place settings of her beautiful pottery and kind of asked, like, do you think anyone else would be interested in chipping in so I could make you, you know, a really big set? And so that's what we ended up doing to register. Instead of getting, you know, some kind of traditional china, we registered with her, and all sorts of family and friends got really excited about that. And we were able to get 8 full place settings and serving dishes and beautiful vases. And it was really lovely and a really special personal gift. And something that surprised us when she finally gave them to us was that each item, each plate and bowl and mug, had the name of the person who had given them. So now, you know, 14 years later, when we sit down to dinner, we have this really special reminder of our community and our family and friends.
That's such a wonderfully personalized gift. What advice would you give people who are getting married and, you know, maybe listening to this program and think, oh, that's cool?
I think just don't be afraid to think outside the box and don't only think about the moment in time right when you're getting married. Like I said, we definitely could have used some cash or help with the honeymoon, but that would be gone by now. And 14 years later, we still have this really special heirloom thing that hopefully someday we can pass down to our daughter.
When Natalie Windsor's friend asked what she wanted as a wedding gift, Natalie came up with a useful present that was also pretty easy on her friend's finances.
Kathy wanted to give me a gift, and she had just been laid off, and I knew she didn't have a lot of outlay, and I said to her, honey, you don't have to give me a gift, and she wasn't happy with that answer. So I came up with the idea of asking her for 2 hours of her time to help me write thank you notes.
Oh, that's a great gift.
And it was a win-win for everybody because, well, first of all, I was marrying this man with 120 relatives in the 3-county area, and I had like 3 relatives and 100 friends, but I had hundreds and hundreds of thank you notes to write. And I was working a full-time job, and there was some, his relatives had never met me, much less seen my handwriting. So because Kathy and I sat together at my kitchen table with tea and cookies and talked to each other, and she'd say, okay, what do you think about the hand mixer? What do you think about the vase? What do you think about? And I would tell her what to write, and then I would write one too. So all of these notes got done twice as quickly as if I'd had to write them all myself. My new in-laws got handwritten thank you notes very, very quickly. And I get to spend time with my friend, and she got to give me a gift that meant something to her and meant something to me.
Yeah, I mean, the best part probably was spending the time with her, right?
That was one of the best parts. Being relieved of the burden of writing hundreds and hundreds of notes was also pretty darn good. But yes, it was just a win-win-win all the way around.
And Jeff Gilmer is getting married this weekend in Houston. We asked him about his registry.
We did register for a lot of the normal necessities that we both have, things like dishes, things like towels, pots and pans, but more to get pieces that are going to be pieces that we'll have for a long time, you know, not those first Walmart dishes that you have or those first cheaper pans that are probably chipping. And but also, you know, the bigger ticket items. I'm a bit more practical. I like putting money towards something big. So that's kind of my line of thinking.
Well, you're raising an interesting question, which is, does one view a registry as a place where you can say, hey, here's this kind of expensive or luxurious item I've always wanted. Let's throw it on there and see what happens.
Or do you
go, oh, gosh, that sends a weird signal?
It's funny. We've had some weird comments from people that, oh, you're registering for $250 sheets or why do you have a $40 candle on your registry? But it's true, because when somebody else is paying for it, you don't feel as bad getting it, if that makes sense. So, for instance, if I was given a gift card for $300 to Crate and Barrel, I probably wouldn't spend all $300 on sheets. But, you know, I'm happy to put that on a registry, and if somebody wants to buy that for me, I'm ecstatic.
What would you think if someone said to you, I don't know, Jeff, like, you're registering for some really fancy stuff. Is it tacky?
I don't think it's tacky, because nobody's forcing them to buy anything in particular. And, you know, weddings are very expensive to put on, and I think that sometimes people forget, you know, how much somebody spends on a wedding to invite them as a guest. And, you know, the gift that they're buying you probably isn't recouping the cost of what you spent just for them to have dinner and listen to the live music and be in the photograph and all of those associated costs with the wedding.
Well, you're making it sound like there's a quid pro quo.
Not exactly, but I think that some people absolutely understand those costs, and that's probably why they're more willing to spend, you know, a good amount of money on a nice gift. And it, you know, it's a celebration. It's, you know, we're really excited to start this journey, or this next chapter in our lives, and excited to have some nice things to kick us off. You know, like I said, we're in our 30s, so we didn't need a lot of things. So it's kind of that opportunity to say, you know, I've always wanted this really nice mixer. I've wanted this, whatever, garbage disposal or whatever it is. It's just an opportunity to say, I could buy this, but why don't you buy it for me?
Congrats to Jeff and Catherine. We are continuing the wedding gift conversation next week with etiquette and advice columnist Carolyn Hacks of The Washington Post. And we want to hear more from you. What gifts did you ask for your wedding, and what did you give others at theirs? Tell us. You can call us at 1-800-648-5114 or leave us a note on our Facebook page. Just search for Marketplace Business News. Now to one of the zeitgeisty stories I mentioned. We talk a lot on this show about technology, what tech companies are doing and making, and how they influence our lives. But we don't often hear what it feels like to live and work inside the Silicon Valley bubble. There is a remarkable essay, though, that details that experience. It's by Anna Weiner in the spring issue of N+1 magazine about her time working at a startup, and it's getting a lot of attention. We asked her to come on and read a little bit of it. Here she is.
Morale is down. We are making plenty of money, but the office is teeming with salespeople, well-groomed social animals with good posture and dress shoes, men who chuckle and smooth their hair back when they can't connect to our VPN. Their corner of the office is loud. Their desks are scattered with freebies from other startups, stickers and koozies and flash drives. We escape for drinks and fret about our company culture. Our culture is dying, we say gravely, apocalyptic prophets all. What should we do about the culture? It's not just the salespeople, of course. It's never just the salespeople. Our culture has been splintering for months. Members of our core team have been shepherded into conference rooms by top-level executives who proceed to question our loyalty. They've noticed the sea change. They've noticed we don't seem as invested. We don't stick around for in-office happy hour anymore. We don't take new hires out for lunch on the company card. We're not hitting our KPIs. We're not serious about the OKRs. People keep using the word paranoid. Our primary investor has funded a direct competitor. This is what investors do, but it feels personal. Daddy still loves us, but he loves us less. We get ourselves out of the office and into a bar. We have more in common than our grievances, but we kick off by speculating about our job security, complaining about the bureaucratic double downs, casting blame for blocks and poor product decisions. We talk about our IPO like it's the deus ex machina coming down from on high to save us. Like it's an inevitability, like our stock options will lift us out of our existential dread, away from the collective anxiety that ebbs and flows. Realistically, we know it could be years before an IPO, if there's an IPO at all. We know in our hearts that money is a salve, not a solution. Still, we are hopeful. We reassure ourselves and one another that this is just a phase. Every startup has its growing pains. Eventually, we are drunk enough to change the subject, to remember our more private selves. The people we are on weekends, the people we were for years. Work has wedged its way into our identities, and the only way to maintain sanity is to maintain that we are the company is us. Whenever we see a stranger at the gym wearing a t-shirt with our logo on it, whenever we are mentioned on social media or on a client's blog, whenever we get a positive support ticket, we share it in the company chat room and we're proud, genuinely proud. But we see now that we've been swimming in the Kool-Aid and we're coming up for air. We were lucky and in thrall, and now we are bureaucrats, punching at our computers, making other people, some kids, unfathomably rich. We throw our dead cigarettes on the sidewalk and grind them out under our toes. Phones are opened and taxis summoned. We gulp the dregs of our beers as cartoon cars approach on screen. 8 hours later, we'll be back in the office, slurping down coffee, running out for congealed breakfast sandwiches, tweaking mediocre scripts and writing half-hearted emails, throwing weary and knowing glances across the table. I skim recruiter emails and job listings like horoscopes, skidding down to the perks. Competitive salary, dental and vision, 401k, free gym membership, catered lunch, bike storage, ski trips to Tahoe, offsites to Napa, summits in Vegas, beer on tap, craft beer on tap, kombucha on tap, wine tastings, whiskey Wednesdays, open bar Fridays, massage on site, yoga on site, pool table, ping pong robot, ball pit, game night, movie night, go-kart, zipline. Job listings are an excellent place to get sprayed with HR's idea of fun and a 23-year-old's idea of work-life balance. Sometimes I forget I'm not applying to summer camp. Customize setup, design your ultimate workstation with the latest hardware, change the world around you, help humanity thrive by enabling next. We work hard, we laugh hard, we give great high fives, we have engineers and top coders, top 20. We're not just another social web app. We're not just another project management tool. We're not just another payment processor. I get a haircut and start exploring.
For more on her story, Uncanny Valley, and her experiences in the tech world, we've got Anna now. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much, Lizzie.
You know, when I first read this, I thought it was fiction, but it's not?
It is fictionalized. I'm curious why you thought it was fiction.
I guess because it almost felt too real to be real, if that makes any sense. So many of these details, maybe it's because I live on the East Coast and I'm not in the tech world, but I thought, oh my God, that must be exaggerated and attenuated to make this startup world seem even crazier than it is.
I wish that were the case. I think that there are instances where things are played down a little bit.
Like, what do you mean?
I heard that feedback specifically from women who said that they thought the piece was pretty gentle with regard to women in tech and sexism.
Yeah, you make the point about sexism, but it doesn't seem to overwhelm a lot of the other stuff in the tech industry. I mean, how much of that did you feel on an everyday basis?
I think that there are two varieties of sexism that I encountered. The first was the sort of cultural sexism in the office. Everyone has a story about a coworker who gets a little too friendly, and then the version that's a little bit more subtle but definitely dangerous, which is the sexism that inhibits women from moving up in their careers.
Why did you decide to write this?
People who are not in this world don't understand what it is. And I think people are curious, but the mainstream representations of Silicon Valley do it sort of a disservice. I've read very little that makes this place seem human while also, you know, speaking to the elements that deserve to be criticized and the elements that deserve to be celebrated. So I was trying to operate in that space.
Do you like working in tech?
I really do. I do still work in the tech industry. I work at another software company. I think that it is the industry that is best poised for social change. The industry I worked in before tech was the book publishing industry, which I have tremendous fondness for. But I was sort of looking around and not seeing a career path that was very exciting to me or that I thought I would be very good at. And I also was seeing a lot of my peers sort of burn out or look at their own career paths and say, this seems unsustainable financially, or I don't want to be answering someone else's phone for 7 years. The tech industry is sort of the foil for that. People are given a lot of agency here at a, you know, often at a very young age. I'm sounding like a booster. I'm actually very cynical about technology, but I do think that there is something to be said for this new style of work.
Well, I finished this piece, and to me, I came away feeling profoundly sad. And I wonder how that strikes you.
Well, I'm sorry that it made you profoundly sad. I've seen a lot of people say that it was depressing. I think that this is a document of a year and a half of my life where I was profoundly sad, and it was a really empty 18 months of my life. And I didn't really know that until I left. Work and identity really do become fused for a lot of people, and they did for me. And trying to find existential value in work is a really tricky gamble. I think some people do it. And for me, I'd moved across the country. I didn't know very many people out here. And I was giving everything to a job that I didn't really feel was giving back.
Anna Wiener, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
You can find a link to Anna Wiener's N+1 piece, Uncanny Valley, at marketplace.org. Next, another big story that I talked about at the top of the show. A few years ago, our China correspondent Rob Schmitz started reporting a series of stories on his own street. He lives on the wonderfully named Street of Eternal Happiness in Shanghai. And as he did more reporting, Rob realized that there was a larger story to tell about modern China and the people who live there. All of this turned into a book. It, too, is named Street of Eternal Happiness, and it's out now. And it's a real pleasure, Rob, to have you here in the studio to talk about it.
It's great to be here.
A lot of books about China look at the economy writ large or what it means for America. Yours is about regular, everyday Chinese people. Why did you make that decision?
I spent a lot of time with people on my street, you know, for years. I was day in, day out, I was with them at their homes, at their workplaces. I traveled to their hometowns with them. I went on religious pilgrimages with them. And to take all of this material and put it into a character-driven narrative, I think is just more interesting. And it's also more educational about the Chinese people, because we see so many books about China that really aren't about the people of China. They're books that try and maybe scare you about China, why we should be afraid of China, or why China's having this impact on the global economy, or why China's is going to dominate the world. But those books aren't about the people of China. Those books are about the leadership of China. It's about the Communist Party. And I refuse to allow China to be defined through the Communist Party, because China is so much more than just the Communist Party. And there are 1.3 billion people in this country, and their dreams and their motivations are very, very interesting.
This week, we see the 50th anniversary of the Cultural Revolution. And when you spend time with people who grew up in the middle of that and who believed or that was part of their everyday life, what is navigating the new China like for them?
It's very difficult. Folks like this, there's a few characters in my book that grew up during that time, and they all have one thing in common. They're lost. This generation is also known as the lost generation because of this. These are people who grew up without, you know, schools were closed during the Cultural Revolution. Teachers were being punished by their students, by the Red Guards, many of them who were teenagers. They were being tortured. Some were being killed. So schools were shut down. They didn't get a chance at an education. And soon after that, they were sent out to the countryside to work. And so their whole lives were really defined by the state. The state would tell them to punish their teachers. The state would tell them to go down to the countryside. And then the state would assign them factory jobs, you know, after the Cultural Revolution was finished. And so they never really, you know, they were adults. They were in their 30s by the time this was all over, and they still hadn't made a single career decision for themselves. And so suddenly, when China opened up in the late 80s, early 90s, and capitalism just came like a train to China, these folks were completely lost, because suddenly capitalism does not tell you where to go and where to work. You have to work hard by yourself. You have to be self-motivated to thrive in a capitalistic economy. And so I think that really defines these characters that I profile. I have one character, Auntie Fu,
right,
who gets caught up in all of these pyramid schemes, and she drags me to one investment meeting after another where she's being scammed, and I'm trying to stop her from doing this. And I find all this information online because she doesn't have enough money to be online. And so I'm showing her, what's wrong with these investments, why this is not a good idea, why you shouldn't be pouring your pension into this. But this is a good example of how these folks think, because they just don't understand how to make money in this day and age. And these get-rich-quick schemes are everywhere in China, and it preys on people of that generation.
Then how do their, children or grandchildren think now?
It's completely different. Their children grew up in an open and a reformed China. And the children oftentimes will pretend to take advice from their parents, but they will never do that because their parents give lousy advice, because their parents do not know how to operate in this society. And so I think that the generations in China and the difference between the different generations in China is vast. And that's something that we should keep in mind, too, because when we look at the leadership of China, I was talking about not going to leadership, but this is something that's interesting about the leadership, is that Xi Jinping comes from the lost generation. He comes from that Cultural Revolution generation. He grew up in the Cultural Revolution, so he understands it, but he was also a bit lost himself. Now, once younger Chinese start to take control of the country, I think we are going to see the beginning of a great change for China, because younger Chinese think completely differently from their parents. And when I say younger, I mean Chinese that are now in their 30s and into their 40s. And so once they start to take the helm of the party and of the country, I think we will see some very interesting changes.
We talked at the top of this about the sort of we should be afraid of China and dragon metaphors that are on book covers and stuff like that. It's the gut level, simple thing that Americans just don't get.
I think the biggest thing that Americans don't get about China is that the Chinese people are a lot like us, a lot like Americans. They're very patriotic. They have a very strong sense of their country. They're confident. They have a very good sense of humor. They're hilarious. They love to rib each other and to give each other a hard time as a joke. And they're family-centered people. Their families are everything to them. And in many ways, I see the Chinese, the individual Chinese people, in the same light as I see Americans. I've traveled around the world, and I actually haven't seen people that are so similar to Americans as the Chinese are. I think that's something that we don't get when we look at the headlines about China, all these scary headlines about the party, because I think the party does not really represent the spirit of the people.
Marketplace's Rob Schmitz. The book is Street of Eternal Happiness. Thank you, Rob.
Thanks, Lizzie.
As I mentioned, Rob's book, Street of Eternal Happiness, is based on a series of stories he did back in 2012 and 2013. We wanted to play some of them for you. First, you heard me and Rob talking about the shift in generational thinking in China. So here's this piece about younger people and how they're finding their way in the Chinese economy.
On the Street of Eternal Happiness, number 810, sounds of a distant revolution spill out of a sandwich shop. Chen Kai plays a rousing rendition of the revolutionary song Taking Tiger Mountain by Strategy on his accordion. It's an old Communist Party song from his parents' generation.
I forgot.
He was forced to learn it as a schoolboy in the 1980s. To him, it means nothing. Chen's generation, Chinese people in their 30s, have grown up in an economy that has grown faster than any other in modern history. They have almost nothing in common with their parents.
My parents grew up in the 1950s during a famine. Sometimes they couldn't even afford to eat. In the 60s and 70s, the government forced them to work as farmers in the countryside. When they went back to the city, they were sent to work in the factories.
Chen's childhood couldn't have been more different. He grew up middle class in an industrial city in Hunan province in the 1980s, a time when Western products and ideas flowed into China for the first time.
It was a beautiful and innocent age. It was sort of like America in the 1960s, but without the free love or drugs. We were becoming more open-minded.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again.
As an aspiring musician, Chen grew up listening to Western groups like Simon and Garfunkel and The Doors. Today, the sound of silence is still a favorite in China's karaoke bars. For Chen's generation, the song conjures up memories not of the 1960s, but the 1980s, which culminated in the student-led protests in Beijing's Tiananmen Square.
The noise of gunfire rose from all over the center of Peking. It was unremitting. On the streets leading down to the main road to Tiananmen Square, furious people stared in disbelief at the glow in the sky, listening to the sound of shots. Heading down the road was a
The message from China's government to Chen's generation was clear. You're free to make money and help build China's economy. Just don't challenge our authority. So with nothing but his accordion and a college degree, Chen reluctantly followed his father's advice and found a job at a state-owned factory where he assembled accordions. He lasted 3 years before he quit.
My father was very angry with me. He kept calling me. He'd say, "You can't just resign like that. You're a manager of a state-owned company. This is the Iron Rice Bowl." I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life, but I knew it wasn't this.
Chen had pulled a luozi, Chinese for naked resignation, quitting a job without first securing another one. More and more urban professionals of Chen's age are doing this. In economic terms, Chen belongs to China's sandwich generation, middle-aged adults who have to provide for their children and their parents. The pressure of being stuck in the middle is intensified for Chen's generation, those who were born under China's one-child policy and don't have any siblings. Li Zixing runs the Chinese website called China 30s, a popular forum for China's sandwich generation.
More than anything, our parents want us to have a stable job. Their generation was thrown out to sea without learning to swim. They don't realize that not only do we know how to swim, but we enjoy it, and we don't need them to throw us a life preserver.
But Li admits the waters of China's economy can make for dangerous swimming.
Those of our generation from the countryside aren't satisfied with being a tiny cog in a huge labor market. I think this can be dangerous because they just end up hanging around.
At the sandwich shop on the Street of Eternal Happiness, Chen Kai rests with his accordion on his lap. It may look like he's hanging around, but no. This member of China's sandwich generation owns the sandwich shop. He opened it with a friend a half a year ago.
Business is okay, but we really believe in what we're doing, and at some point, we'll have success.
Before the lunch rush hits, Chen plays another song. This one's not revolutionary. It's just a little piece he wrote after he quit his job a few years ago. And now, here he is, at his shop on the Street of Eternal Happiness, with an instrument his father pushed him to learn. His government taught him to build, playing a song he created. And sure, it's not as polished as the communist songs he memorized as a child, but this one is from his heart.
In this next story, Rob spends some time with a group of urban professionals who are trying to cope with modern life by reviving some very old ideas.
When you take a stroll among the steel and glass towers of downtown Shanghai, you could be anywhere. Sometimes in this city, it's easy to forget you're in China. And then suddenly, there it is. China. A beggar sits on a curb of the Street of Eternal Happiness, playing the flute. The skyscraper behind him releases a stream of office workers in black suits. They pass by on their way to the subway. Today's Rush Hour soundtrack brought to you by the Ming Dynasty, a tune from 500 years ago, a reminder that China has thousands of years of history, and more of these office workers want to reconnect with it. A converted apartment in a quiet lane just off the Street of Eternal Happiness is packed with young urban professionals. They're drinking tea and taking notes from a professor who's teaching them how to write classical poetry. Each week, they come here to discuss the teachings from the era of Confucius, 2,500 years ago. Liu Xun helps run this club.
Now the society is going in a very fast pace. Some people like it. Some people have to cope with it, but some people, they really don't like it.
China's breakneck economic growth is bewildering to outsiders. Even if you're an insider, it can make your head spin. Liu says many young professionals are desperately seeking ways to cope with the pressures of 21st century China.
It's always a good thing to go back and check what your ancestors have done. Maybe they have thought all these things over and over again, and they already have very good answers to you.
On this day, 10 members have dressed up in traditional bright-colored silk robes that were hip more than 2,000 years ago during the Qin Dynasty. They walk as a group along the Street of Eternal Happiness. People just stare. Shen Zifeng and Zhu Jiaqing say they do this from time to time to remind other Chinese about their traditional culture.
The problem is many Chinese think we're wearing Japanese or Korean clothes.
They have no idea. Each time we go out, we always have to remind people that this is our traditional clothing.
The club's co-founder, Xu Yuan, says many Chinese suffer from this type of cultural amnesia because of decades of revolution and economic transformation.
Many Chinese have forgotten what it means to be Chinese, yet their habits and behavior reflect an ancient tradition. Rediscovering who they are is really important.
In just 2 years, this small club has attracted more than 50,000 people to its events. It's part of a larger movement in China to revive Confucian thought, from thousands of cultural centers like this one to hundreds of Chinese government-funded Confucius institutes all over the world. Cultural critic Zhu Dake, a professor at Shanghai's Tongji University, is skeptical about the Confucian revival.
The government is rich, but the people are not. They're in a constant state of anxiety, so they seek out traditional philosophies from the time of Confucius. That encourages you not to worry so much about material gains and instead focus on the bright side of life. I think it's a way to hypnotize yourself rather than to proactively change the circumstances that cause your anxiety in the first place.
Zhu says China's Communist Party is promoting a Confucian revival because the party's original ideology is wearing thin. Zhu would rather see Chinese people embrace non-Confucian aspects of Chinese history, such as Taoism, which places a greater emphasis on a harmonious relationship with nature, something he says China, with its terrible environmental record, could use. Back on the Street of Eternal Happiness, Zheng Jianfei, dressed in a black silk robe from the Qin Dynasty, says there's a big debate in China about which parts of its cultural tradition the country should embrace going forward.
Some say we should develop Chinese society with unique Chinese characteristics. Others say we should continue to embrace Western culture. And some even say we should step back to feudal society with an emperor. Who knows?
But tonight, there's a more pressing matter to figure out. On their walk in their traditional Chinese costumes, the group gets lost on a winding road, unsure of where they are. No need to worry, Zheng tells the others. If we just keep walking, he says, we'll find our destination. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
If you want to read more of Rob's wonderful reporting, you can pick up Street of Eternal Happiness in stores now. And that's our show for this week. Next week, we are keeping our discussion on wedding gifts going. So tell us the stories about what you asked for. What do you still use? What was the most unusual thing you got? Let us know by visiting marketplace.org. You can chat with us on Marketplace's Facebook page or call us 1-800-648-5114. And yes, your voice might be featured on the air. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Eliza Mills and Raghu Manavalan. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer. Chris Clark is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.